യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാമലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ കൃമാദ്വിവരണസ്യ ച. So in the last session we were dealing with this sutra number 9 of Vibhudipada. So in a printed book it will be third chapter. This sutra defines what is technically called Nirodha Parinama, which is the highest level of mental transformations. So we have to remember the three types of mental transformation that we were discussing. First one is, for the highest one is Nirodha Parinama, and then Samadhi Parinama and Ekagrata Parinama, of which in an ascending order, from gross to more and more subtle levels of transformation, we can say the highest one is Nirodha Parinama that we are discussing now, and the lowest one is Samadhi Parinama. It is not Samadhi, it is one state of mental transformation. The word Parinama should be kept in mind. And the middle one is Ekagrata Parinama. So I already explained, I gave a general idea of this Parinama, the word Parinama or transformation in the last session. It's a very important word when you study yoga and Sankhya, and also Vedanta. So to begin with, the concept of creation of the world is discussed, or creation of anything. Of course, here in the yoga system, we are discussing the transformation taking place at a mental level as we practice higher and higher forms of yoga. We all undergo transformation, actually. Every action that we do will have some effect on the mind. And mind, of course, directly influences the way we act, behave, think, so on. Now, from the cosmic point of view, as I mentioned in the last session, there are two views with regard to creation. One view is creation is real transformation. It is called real parinama. It is called parinamavada, the school of real transformation. Sankhya and yoga, schools of philosophy, believe that prakriti undergoes parinama or transformation and becomes this created universe. And also our mind, our intellect, our senses of action, senses of perception, all these are different evolutes of prakriti. This is a central thesis in Sankhya philosophy. The metaphysical, the philosophical teachings of yoga are taken from Sankhya philosophy. Now, when those who are beginners, I would say a few things about Sankhya yoga, these were terms. There are many beginners, frequently. So, of course, I discussed this many times, but frequently, the newcomers in every session. The world of Indian philosophy is divided into two central classifications. One is called the orthodox schools of philosophy. Six orthodox schools of philosophy. The other is six unorthodox or non-orthodox or heterodox schools of philosophy. Now, how do you judge whether a school of philosophy is orthodox or not? In Indian philosophical system, interestingly, If you do not believe in God, you do not become non-orthodox. So there are many systems of philosophy which do not openly affirm the existence of a God. For example, the Sankhya philosophy itself, yoga philosophy itself. In the earlier yoga system of Kapila, Kapila was an ancient thinker, his system of philosophy was theistic, in that way believed in God, and non-dualistic. But the text on Sankhya system of philosophy, rather the Bible of Sankhya philosophy, that you buy from markets today, is a book, it's called Sankhya Karika. Karika is a collection of verses. They're all in metrical form. It's called Sankhya Karika. The Sankhya Karika was written by a thinker called Ishvara Krishna. And Ishvara Krishna doesn't specifically mention the existence of a God. But the Sankhya and Yoga system believe in the authority of the Vedas. So if you believe in authority of Vedas, then your system of philosophy is orthodox. It is theistic. So theism in Vedantic tradition, in Hindu tradition, doesn't necessarily imply belief or the lack of it in God. So that's one important point to remember. So the earliest, and they say, according to historians, those who specialize on comparative study of philosophy, they say the earliest and the most ancient system of human thought is Sankhya system of philosophy. So that's why modern comparative philosophers have found traces of Sankhya thought system in the systems of Heraclitus and in many of the even early Thalists who lived in 7th century, 6th and 7th century BC, mind you, not AD. So the even Greek thinkers who lived before Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, who belonged to 6th or 7th or 8th century BC, even in their systems of thought, there are very strong, this is a very strong influence of the Sankhya metaphysics. That is the conclusion of modern comparative writers on comparative philosophy, both Oriental and Occidental, Western and Eastern. So he wrote one book. It's called Sankhya Sutra. Sutras, again, small aphorisms, small statements. Not long sentence, necessarily. It could be long sentence also. It is called Sankhya Sutra. And it was written by Kapila. And Kapila was an ancient sage who may have lived maybe some millennium, a few millennium BC, a few thousands of years before Jesus. So, but that book is not yet available. That text is not available. But Kapila's teachings are found in one ancient classical book. And there also, Kapila is referred to, mentioned as an ancient sage, lived in prehistorical times. And there is a clear exposition of Sankhya philosophy in the Bhagavata Purana, where Kapila is extolled, deified as an incarnation, or as an incarnation of God. God means some divine powers. He was born with some divine powers. His system of philosophy was Advaitic or non-dualistic and theistic. But right now, what we get from the shop is not the Sankhya of Kapila, because that book is not available. Some quotations you find in some ancient books of Buddhist thinkers and also yoga philosophers and Sankhya philosophers. The book that you find today in the shop is Sankhya Karika, Ishvara Krishna. He may have lived perhaps in the 4th century AD. He also refers to some ancient thinkers like Asudi, Panchashikha, and so on. So that is the history. Why we are talking about Sankhya, we should remember. Yoga system is more of an application, science of application of practices, disciplines, to control our mind, to understand our personality, to reveal the mystery of how and why we act and think and speak the way we are acting, thinking and speaking. If you are asking the question, you know, which psychology cannot think. Psychology can say, why at all should you have this problem? Psychology and modern science also have no answer. So the answer to the question, why? How we can answer? You can get an answer for the question how from modern science and psychology. But why? That's the question. So the Sankhya and yoga thinkers, especially yoga thinkers, they reveal the mystery of human emotions, human mind, human behavior patterns, going beyond the behavior patterns that could be explained through psychology and psychiatry. For example, if we have some peculiar habits which are self-destructive, which we may not get rid of, we are not able to get rid of it. So what do? You take some medicine to forget it, or to postpone the problem for a future. So the problem returns. But yoga psychology tells you, why at all should you have a problem? Is there any way out of this problem? So that's about yoga. Sankhya system gives the philosophical, metaphysical background of yoga. That's the difference. So we should know a lot about Sankhya philosophy to understand yoga psychology. So as I mentioned, Sankhya philosophy is very, very frankly dualistic. That means it recognizes two ultimate fundamental categories, Purusha and Prakriti, we already discussed. And whatever you find in this world is really an evolution of this Prakriti and Purusha. Now how this evolves, that should be understood. So as I mentioned, Purusha and Prakriti are two fundamental categories of Sankhya philosophy, which is accepted by yoga also. Purusha is intelligent, self-effulgent, consciousness, knowledge, awareness, all this. Prakriti is dead matter. It's all matter. So we may call it matter and energy. It's a prelude to this concept, matter and energy. Energy is associated with action. And action is associated with ability to think, awareness, knowledge, etc. A dead matter cannot think or move. So the Sankhya philosophers say there are two fundamental categories. And the whole universe, including the mountains, rivers, and valleys, animal kingdom, plants and trees, and ourselves, our mind, our intellect, all this constitutes different evolutes of this Prakriti. As I mentioned earlier, the yoga system gives a very rational, scientific analysis of human behavior and thought patterns. But it doesn't give a very rational spiritual conclusion, a conclusion from a spiritual point of view. That is why Vedanta philosophers say yoga should culminate in Vedanta. Sankhya and yoga get their fulfillment in Vedanta, because Vedanta gives the answer, continues the journey, the quest, the search, where Sankhya and yoga live somewhere. So as I mentioned, Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is inactive, but it is full of effulgence and knowledge. Prakriti is active. Now that's a big problem in the Sankhya system, metaphysically. How can a dead matter be the ground, the foundation for all evolution? For that there is no real answer, because Sankhya and Yoga traditions did not produce a succession of thinkers and teachers who updated the philosophical conclusions from time to time, as it happened in Vedanta. In Vedanta, you find if you go all the way to the Vedic times, to our own times, there is a succession of teachers. Maybe the latest example is Vivekananda. What Vivekananda taught was nothing but a new scientific rational exposition of what the ancient sages taught and what Buddha interpreted in humanistic terms. So that's all. Vivekananda did not teach. That's why he said, Vivekananda said, I preach nothing but the Upanishads. Upanishads are the conclusions of the Vedas. So you find in Vedantic tradition an unbroken succession of teachers who come from time to time and give some kind of readjustment, not only to scriptures, but also to the fundamental principles. Fundamental principles, of course, are not altered, but the way they're interpreted becomes different. I mean, it is a constant adaptation of the great ideas from time to time. Old wine is put in new bottles from time to time with new brand names and marketers. Otherwise, you won't drink it. The old bottle, dirty bottle, broken bottle. So, it is put in new brand names. So, every teacher is doing the Vivekananda expounded Vedanta philosophy in the language of modern science, modern technology, in an age when the world was slowly becoming one, actually, in a way. But that sort of thing did not happen in Sankhya Yoga tradition. But still, Patanjali laid down to an absolutely marvelous analysis of human mind and human emotions and human ideas, which were again reinterpreted by a number of thinkers and philosophers, both Buddhist and also Hindu, Vedantic. But that succession did not take the form of a spiritual revival, there was not a constant adaptation of those great ideas to our own times. So I shall just give an idea of the Sankhya concept of evolution. So as I said, there are two fundamental categories, Purusha and Prakriti. From Prakriti, the first evolute is Mahat, Buddhi. From Mahat, Ahankara, the ego principle. And this Ahankara has got three categories, Sattva, Rajoguna, and Tamoguna. Often they get mixed up. Our mind, five senses of action, five senses of perception. That means sense organs and motor organs, and mind. It's called Indriyas, senses. They emerge from Sattva, Guna, but there is Rajoguna involved a little, otherwise this transformation, this Parinama will not take place. As for the Tamasika Ahankara, the subtle elements called Tanmatras, and from Tanmatras, the five subtle elements which constitute the world is coming to existence. This is their conclusion. This is an interesting aspect of Sankhya evolution. Okay, now, here the question arises, I often I had to encounter this question from very, very informal, non-orthodox circles. See, if you say that the whole universe, how do they explain? The San Francisco Bay and the hills and mountains, rocks and trees and animals, they evolve from Prakriti, we can understand. But what about our mind, our intellect? Then, if they are all evolutes, then what's the difference between a piece of rock and a human being? So simple, if they are all evolutes of Prakriti, so piece of rock and human beings. Sankhyas, of course, from a Sankhya perspective, we can find one answer. The answer is, in human beings, there is a reflecting medium, we may call it a unit which has got four compartments. In Sanskrit, we call mana, buddhi, citta, and ahankara. But let us say mind, intellect, then accumulation of memories, and the awareness that I am the one. Even you see an object, recollect, well, this object I saw last week because the memory is registered in the mind. In one department of this mental system, it's called antakarana in Sanskrit. And then you recollect, you are the one who saw that object last week, so you identify yourself as the one who saw it. And before you really approached, saw it, you are not sure what it was, what that object was. You saw it from a distance in semi-darkness. You didn't know what it was. And when you really approached it, you understand it is such an object, a human being or a pillar or a post, whatever it is. So all these faculties together constitute a mental system, a psychical system, which in Sanskrit is called antakarana, internal organs. A piece of rock doesn't have it. And mountains and valleys do not have it. Human beings and other living beings do have them, but in varying degrees of manifestation. So in answer to this problem, Vivekananda made an interesting statement. He was actually talking about the Sankhya evolution theory. And you see, surprisingly, he found many admirers in this country who agreed with him, the concept of evolution. And he used the word involution, which later became a part of conversation among intellectual circles in the early decades of 20th century. So, like that, from subtle, the gross evolves. From the gross, less subtle, more and more gross evolves. So when evolution takes place, there is complete transformation. Like that, through yogic practices, our mind also can undergo transformation. First, it develops the capacity to focus on one great noble ideal with awareness. So that's an interesting, important principle to remember. The ability to focus on something with perfect awareness means the ability to choose and focus on things with freedom. It's not that we are attached to it. And unless we have this freedom, we cannot really evolve in spiritual life. It is lack of freedom that is the stumbling block in our spiritual life. If all of us read great books, listen to great ideas, and we take a decision, well, this is a wonderful thing to practice. Even not only spiritual things, even ordinary noble deeds, good deeds, we can take a decision. We take a decision, but that decision we are frequently not able to implement. Especially the higher decisions at the mental intellectual level that we are not able to implement. At the gross physical level, we can do whether we want to eat apple or orange. Nobody will stand in your way. You can buy an apple and eat. It's a physical thing. But what thought we should think, what word we should speak, which we can control to some extent. But still, if you not control the thought behind, and if you have control to some extent your words, still those words will not really work. Because there is a slight difference between the thought and word, then also, we won't be able to do or think or speak with freedom. So freedom or awareness, it makes the difference between a spiritually elevated person and all others. So what I wanted to stress was, when you reach this freedom, then you reach the highest level of Nirodha Parinama, which we discussed in the last class. So Vyutthana Nirodha Samskarayohu Abhibhava Pradurbhavu Nirodha Kshanachittanyeha Nirodha Parinamaha. Means all the samskaras of Vyutthana, it means Sampragnyada Yoga, they are subdued by the dominant samskaras of Nirodha, where all the vrittis have been completely controlled. When we are able to control all the vrittis, then we also will be able to control all our actions and thoughts. So they, at that stage, we are able to do things with freedom and awareness. So, and then it says, this sutra says, the change with the mind undergoes every moment of that controlled state is called Nirodha Parinama. That's what the sutra says. So, when this awareness comes, what happens? We feel freedom. Now, as I mentioned just now, what stands in the way of really doing what we want to do, thinking what we want to think? I mentioned lack of freedom. That's true. But why no freedom? Why this slavery? Yoga philosophers have explained this mystery. This is samskara. We have something in our system, in our character. An accumulated body of samskaras. Samskaras are always related to some kind of action we have done. Action doesn't mean necessarily physical actions. We think something, that thought produces a samskara. We do something, that also produces a samskara. We speak a word, that also produces a samskara. So this samskara, accumulated samskara, stand in the way of our really doing what we want to do. A stumbling block. So we have to go deeper, you know. So that's the purpose of yoga. At the behavioral level, you cannot solve this problem. Impossible. So, that's why the three levels of mental transformations are mentioned. Samadhi Parinama, the lowest. Ekagrata Parinama, the higher. And Nirodha Parinama, the highest. At the Nirodha stage, what happens? Nirodha Samskara means where all the vrittis are completely controlled. That stage takes place. Then what happens? Samskaras themselves, the old samskaras, tendencies, which stood in the way of our spiritual progress, they get completely wiped out. But better word is, they completely get processed. That's why I mentioned, you know, we can have democracy at the political level, but we cannot have democracy at the emotional level, thought level. Impossible. Everyone should think the same thing. Impossible. Everyone should behave in the same manner. Impossible. No egalitarianism, no uniformity at the thought level. Because we are all come with our own bundles of accumulated samskaras, which go far deeper than even actions in this life. So we can't get out of it. But there is a way to do that. Of course, the first two steps are always the same, yama and niyama. But these are all, what now we are talking about advanced practices, but we already mentioned the first two practices, I mean the stage that we begin with, yama and niyama. Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Parigraha, Shauja, Santosha, Tapaswadhyaya, Ishwara Pradhana. It means non-violence, non-stealing, non-possessiveness, a pure life, and then inner purity, outer purity, contentment, reading good scriptures, feeding the mind with good ideas and surrender to God, and any of these practices will be helpful. But the fundamental practices are yamas and then niyamas. So once we do this, we become slowly fit for higher practices. Asana, pranayama, pratyahara. So these are the three mental transformations that we discussed. So now we will go to the next sutra, which is very important, from a philosophical point of view. Tasya prashanta sakhita samskarat. Here samskarat, here means by the power of nirodha samskara, means the highest mental transformation, where we have gone beyond the first two levels of concentration, and finally we have reached the highest level of mental transformation is called Nirodha Samskara. Tasya Prashanta Vahida Samskara. So by this power of this Nirodha Samskara, that transformation continues, it goes on without a break. Now this part of the sutra are being commented upon by many thinkers and many philosophers. It's very interesting, you know, how these ancient masters could manage to understand what is going on in our minds. It's very interesting. Now, what is the meaning of the sutra? They're explaining this. The idea is, at the beginning of this Nirodha Parinama, in this sutra, as we've been discussing this sutra, there is always a struggle between Vyutthana Samskara and Nirodha Samskara. Vyutthana Samskara is the previous one, Samprajnata. So whenever we try to practice any kind of mental transformation, there is always a conflict between what we are trying to change and what we are trying to newly gain. So what happens is, slowly as we increase our concentration, owing to the moments of these three gunas, sattva guna, rajo guna, and tamo guna, Nirodha Samskaras go on changing, but then this imperceptible flow of the mind stuff is called Prashanta Vahita. So what is happening is, when we get established in Nirodha Samskara, the mind reaches a level of steadiness. And while explaining this particular sutra, one of the great commentators say, Vitthana Samskara Mala Rehida Nirodha Parambara Matra Vahida Prashanta Vahida. Isn't it interesting? What it means is this. Nirodha Samskara means stopping of all vrittis. And also uninterrupted succession of Nirodha Samskara. I mean, it becomes completely pure, free from all impurities. And at this Nirodha Samskara level, mind is always free, it becomes established in purity and peace, so at the time it is completely free from all vrittis. Now, I know that this technical quotation needs some explanation. What exactly is happening? First of all, the commentators they're trying to imply that when we try to practice yoga, there is always a conflict between our present accumulated state of samskaras in our mind, creating stumbling blocks in our forward path. This not only in yoga, but the moment you turn to spiritual life, immediately you find our mind divides itself into two categories, common experience. One part of the mind cooperates, helps us in doing good deeds, trying to practice meditation, prayer, or whatever it is. Another part of the mind apparently tries to create a stumbling block. The later one, the later half, meaning the mind that is creating a stumbling block, is nothing but the accumulated samskaras, tendencies, which refuse to cooperate with a new action or new meditative practice. But as we continue our journey, when we reach the highest level of this Nirodha Samskara, where mind is completely free from vrittis, what happens? Those stumbling blocks or obstacles, negative thought currents that stand in the way of continuing spiritual practice, slowly they fade away. This opposition could often take the it manifests in so many different ways. One method may be postponement, procrastination. Another, the mind itself as if creates a justification for not doing it. And you find, if you have not taken to spiritual life, these problems did not exist, really speaking. But you turn to spiritual life, we are actually trying to create a new set of higher samskaras. This sutra deals with the highest level where even the higher samskaras themselves are wiped out, where mind becomes vritti shunya, completely free from all vrittis, all tendencies. But at the lower level, even before we reach this level, you find this conflict between the accumulated samskaras which already have formed our character, behavior, our natural thought system, and a new spiritual ideal that we want to practice. So, one of the reasons why Patanjali emphasized yamas as the universal principles, Mahabhauma, he said, means yamas are so universal, which everyone should practice. Non-violence, non-possessiveness, non-stealing, and truthfulness, and so on. Non-receiving of things, mean complete freedom from greed, want, desire, complete contentment. And also internal truthfulness. Once we get established in these values, then these conflicts will not arise, or the conflicts will be less. Because every conflict is an expression to get something, to do something, to think something which is not helpful in spiritual life. That's why there is one statement in one of our scriptures that will be very interesting. Every spiritual seeker, when you try to take to spiritual life, has to go through the whole cycle of past life. That is a very interesting thing. It is a statement, but which explains this obstacle. The way you heard about Buddha, of course. You know. Buddha had to go through so many obstacles, which all were related to his previous, hundreds of previous lives. This is a metaphorical description of this. So when we take to spiritual life, we are actually, even with a strong desire for spiritual liberation, actually we are trying to go beyond the cycle. So all the accumulated thoughts and samskaras and tendencies that we have accumulated in all previous life, they come in subtle thought forms, maybe only flashes. So they are obstacles. So all these obstacles get completely, they completely vanish. They can be overcome when we attain this level of the third parinama, third mental transformation called nirodha parinama. And that's the only stage where we get completely free and we reach the level of spiritual awareness. So that's why the play or the obstacles created by previous tendencies and samskaras is metaphorically, figuratively described as a replay of all your previous lives. Because all the samskara is just like a huge, it's a deep well. There are different levels and layers of filth and dirt and all sorts of things, bacteria accumulated various layers of the lake. So when we clean it up, all this will come to the surface and then we have to remove. So when we reach higher and higher levels of mental transformation, what happens? When we completely refuse to identify with these emerging thought currents, conflicting thought currents, then we overcome them. So how do we overcome? That's an interesting thing. We should not welcome those thought currents which stand in the way of spiritual life. You should not fight them. Because fighting and welcoming, identification with those thought currents and also trying to forcibly fight against them, both will get you attached to it. You get connected to it. So what to do? Keeping a long distance. Which means mentally we disown, or what do you call, we refuse to identify ourselves with that. We have nothing to do with this. So once we understand this is natural for the human mind to throw up all the accumulated layers of samskaras coming from previous life, then they slowly vanish. Mind reaches a very high level of peace. This is the idea behind it. So now, in fact, in a way, the periods of austerities that even great spiritual teachers practiced are nothing but fight against the previously accumulated samskaras. That's one way. Instead of that, often we project, put a devil came and tempted through me, took me away from the seat. Devil asked me to come out of the seat and stop doing japa. The devil asked me not to go to the church or a temple. Like that, it's easy to put the whole blame on a being, Maybe that's only one way of anthropomorphism, But Patanjali says, the yoga text says, actually these are things coming from our own mind. So once we know this, then we can stop doing those things again. Otherwise, you put the whole thing on devil, so it's none of, I have nothing to do, the devil is responsible for everything. So then practically we have no role in it. But Buddhism says, and Buddhism took all these ideas from this. There are long descriptions of how Buddha encountered temptations from Mara, from previous life experiences came and all that. You find that. So like that, once we understand, my thought doesn't permit me, my mind doesn't permit me to meditate. My mind doesn't permit me to do something noble. But it's not because the devil is not permitting me, because it's my mind is not permitting me, because I'm doing something which I have not done previously. So I must do some noble deed. That means we have to take the whole responsibility on our own shoulders. That's how Patanjali goes about. You can see very intricate, deep analysis of human mind. That the yoga system does not accept the theory of evil. Yoga system accepts the theory of previous samskaras, the theory of error, so to speak, from a purely dialectical standpoint. We can have interaction questions. Before the interaction, I want to make a very important announcement. We will not have class next Friday, October the 21st, because of our old temple rededication programs over the weekend. The next class will be on Friday, November the 4th at 7:30 p.m. here in this hall. So please remember, we have an important program next weekend, that is on 29th and 30th October. So we will not have Friday class next Friday, that is October the 21st. So please remember, on October 29th, Saturday, we have an important celebration here in our lecture hall, in Bellevue Street here, in this shrine. We will have a puja worship as part of the rededication ceremony of the old temple. You have to remember, this is the first Hindu temple in Western world. It is completed 1906. Many people don't know even that. And it was built as a symbol of interfaith harmony, the central principle of Vedanta. It teaches us that all religions are equally valid paths leading to God. No matter what religion we are born into, if you are pure, sincere, you will reach God. So that this idea was given an architectural symbolism in this temple. So we will have the rededication of that temple, but the program is taking place here in the new temple. So the program is on October 29th, Saturday, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. in our lecture hall. There will be puja. And then, much more important, the next day, on October 30th, Sunday, we will have an audio-visual presentation of the first Hindu temple in the whole Western world, an audio-visual presentation. That also will be held in the lecture hall. And then from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. in the afternoon, we will have our major public program. There will be lectures, talks on various spiritual subjects, how this temple, this old temple came to be built. So you get an idea how spiritual life was going on in this country during the early decades of 20th century. So we will have a benediction by Bishop William Swing, the Episcopal Diocese of California. And we will have special guests, Swamis, monks coming from India. And also we'll have Professor Michael Nagler, Professor Emeritus of UC Berkeley. He will speak on the subject significance of the first Hindu temple. So the whole program will be over by around 5:30. And please remember, at the end of the program, you will get a marvelous gift in the form of a book which contains very learned articles, photos, pictures, newspaper clips from the early years of 20th century, and also a number of other items related to the old temple. So please remember to be present for this program. The audiovisual presentation at 1 o'clock and the public meeting from 2 to 5:30 p.m. on Sunday, October the 30th. So thank you. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Now we have interaction. Yes, we have time, I believe, about 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes.
Swamiji, you spoke of the three gunas, and there's the nirgunas too. So with nirguna, how would that enhance the transcendental or the integration of the jiva atman?
Nirguna really means, in Sanskrit it's called gunadita, going beyond all gunas. It is not devoid of all gunas. When you reach a level where you are not affected by the fluctuation of these gunas, then when you transcend the three, you transcend conflicts. So long as you are established even in Sattvaguna, which is the highest, noblest, still there is some possibility of suddenly maybe deviating into Rajoguna or Tamoguna. There is the chance cannot be fully, completely ruled out. But when you reach the highest level, you go beyond all the three gunas. So that's the real meaning of the word nirguna. Nir is actually prefix, one of the, what you call upasarga. The prefix can really, literally, in ordinary grammar, it could mean devoid of, free from, having nothing. But in this particular context, nirguna means, guna atita means going beyond all the three gunas. That's a real meaning. It's based on one central principle in Vedic grammar. See, in Vedic grammar, this may nothing to do with the yoga, but still for information. In Vedic grammatical system, you can, every word has got a root, and every root is capable of being interpreted in so many different ways. So that's why, sarvesham shabdanam dhatu jattvam, dhatu nam anekarthatvam cha. This is a central principle in Vedic grammar. Every word, shabda, is born from a dhatu, a root. And every root can have different meaning according to different context. You find the standardization of Vedic grammar took place long before 9th century. Because 9th century, 8th, 9th century was the period when Panini standardized modern Sanskrit grammar. Today's Sanskrit that we write today, its grammatical rules were formulated, remember, in 8th century BC. And modern British English was standardized by Fowler and Hornby in 20th century, maybe 40s. And American language was practically interpreted by Chomsky, maybe 30, 40 years back. But Sanskrit language that we use today, its grammar, its syntax, all the rules and regulations, prefixes, suffixes, all these were absolutely, completely, and finally formulated in 8th century BC, remember, by Panini. The Vedic grammar is still much more ancient. It belongs to around 2500 BC. So in those days, language was still in its state of infancy. Philosophy was so advanced. So what happens, the same word could be interpreted in different contexts, in different ways. Of course, I'm not deviating too much into grammar and history of film. So this is an interesting principle. Okay, Raj.
Maharaj, two questions. Yeah. One is, I don't know if you'll have time to cut. I just wanted to understand the difference between tanmatras and sanskaras. And then the second question is to just understand, I think, what you're trying to say, the idea of the antahkarna, the idea is to purify the antahkarna. Yeah. So that Purusha can reflect through the buddhi more, in a more clear way. Yeah. And so you talked about the practice of meditation in order to do that.
If you conclude now, then I can answer the first two questions and come to third. Otherwise, I have to write down each question.
I just wanted to understand then. Because you talked a little bit about the practice of meditation to purify the antahkarna, but what about the other practices?
Okay, first coming to the first subject that you mentioned, that's about tanmatras and samskaras. Please remember, samskaras mean the residual forms of our actions and thoughts, which are more abstract, more subtle than vrittis, and vrittis themselves are the residual factors of actions. To give an example, when you do something, when you speak something or a thought comes to your mind, after that action is over, the word is spoken, after the thought is over, still there is something that remains in a mental system. Mental system called chitta. That residual element is called vritti. Now, that vritti, a number of vrittis, identical actions, thoughts, come together. They come together and they themselves form a subtle tendency. If the action or the experience is pleasant, you will have a tendency to repeat. If it is unpleasant, you have a tendency to run away from that. That subtle aspect is called samskara. So that is samskara. And tanmatra is totally different. Tanmatras are the subtler forms of Pancha Mahabhudas. Yes. Tanmatras, they evolve from the tamasika ahankara. As I mentioned, from Prakriti, the cosmic intelligence, Mahatattva comes. From Mahatattva, ahankara comes. Ahankara has three dimensions. Ahankara means how we identify the ego system. Sattvika ahankara, from that mind comes. And also, the sattvika ahankara, of course, it has to get mixed up with the little rajoguna. Then mind, the five karmendriyas, five jnanendriyas, five senses of action, senses of perception, and mind, they all come from the sattvika dimension. And the tamasika dimension, you know, tanmatras come. So what is a tanmatra? Let us say fire is an element, one of the five elements. The fire has got a quality, something that makes fire a fire, or something that makes water water. Something which you take away from water, it will lose its property, its ability to function as water. That is called tanmatra. Pancha tanmatra. So in other words, the tanmatras are the subtler dimensions of Mahabhudas. So from each tanmatra, that is when there is called, you see, Akasha tanmatra, Vayu tanmatra, Agni tanmatra, all they have got tanmatras. From each of them, Agni, Akasha, all this emerge. Exactly. When they become visible, functional form, it is called Mahabhudas. When they are subtle dimensions, it is called Tanmatras. So in other words, Tanmatras are the evolutes of the Tamasiga aspect of Ahankara. Ahankara. Ahankara originated from Mahatattva. And Mahatattva from Prakriti. So, please remember, the Tanmatras are the causal forms of Mahabhudas. What are Mahabhudas? Mahabhudas are what constitute this visible cosmos. The whole visible cosmos, they are constituted by the Pancha Mahabhudas. Pancha Bhudas. And their subtle dimension, this causal dimension, is Tanmatra. So the causal dimension is more subtle and the effect is gross compared to the cause. That's always so. And you're talking about, I explained samskaras and tanmatras. Next question that you raised was about the meditation or the antakarana. I tried to explain. Well, you know, in a way, antakarana constitutes our character.
That's the whole idea, right? Exactly.
What we are, in fact, antakarana is our true personality. At the grosser level, we often, when we use the word personality, we mean what is visible. But the personality, real personality, is behind the visible form. What is that real personality? The real personality is antakarana. This antakarana, in a way, I shall try to explain how it constitutes a real personality. Antakarana has got four dimensions, four elements. One is mind. So mind speculates, mind thinks. So mind is always wavering. Okay, Now, this can be explained with the help of an illustration. Suppose you see an object in front of you at some distance and there is not enough light. You could interpret that object as a human form or a pillar, let us say. You are not sure. Your mind is fluctuating, speculating. That is called Sankalpa Vikalpadmiga Antakarna Vritti Mana. So this, what it means is, mind is that which functions as speculative faculty, thinking this way or that way. And when you reach the objects and you see the object in front of you, then you understand, oh, I thought this was a human being, but it's only a pillar. So who decides the pillar? Is the buddhi or intellect? Intellect. So mind that speculates before you reach the object, and the intellect or buddhi that decides, well, this is a pillar, not a human being. It doesn't end there. Now afterwards, you suddenly remember, oh, I saw the same pillar last week or last day. So where did you store that memory? In your mental system. For that part of the mental system where you store this memory is called chittam. Remember, it is not exactly the chittam that we use in yoga. So here chittam should be understood as that part of the mental system where the memories and impressions are accumulated, stored. Okay, then you identify yourself as the one who saw this last week. That is your ahankara. So these four elements together constitute our personality. That's why, you know, every human being is bringing with him a bundle. And that bundle contains samskaras, tendencies, impressions gathered not from this life alone but from previous life. That's why we act differently. I mentioned earlier, you know, you cannot have emotional democracy. We cannot have, everyone should have the same emotion, not possible. That's why. Yeah, the next subject is meditation. I'll come to that. Okay. But, well, you know, so as I mentioned, we have inherited these tendencies which we call antakarana. Now about yoga, as you mentioned, meditation. Now what path do we accept for our spiritual life? Karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga. Well, everyone knows within herself or in himself what is his chosen path. But remember, no one can really practice one yoga to the exclusion of all other three. It is impossible. It is impossible. There's no doubt about it. So, but then what yoga we put much more emphasis than other yogas? That can decide, that can be different from individual to individual. So, those who are of an emotional turn of mind, those who they themselves, in our own system, we feel at home with certain ways of practicing our religion. In fact, the spiritual, the real truth, the fact is that no one can really decide what path is the right path for you. When we do some spiritual practice, and when we feel inner peace and blissfulness and contentment, and when we feel no conflict, then that path is our path. Now, excuse me now, because it's not proper to have a... Let us listen to some other... If other, there are more questions from others, please come. So we should remember the samskaras have got a background, actions. So if undesirable samskaras are caused by undesirable actions. Then we can produce desirable samskaras through desirable actions. So doing good deeds, thinking good thoughts, speaking good words, try to think of higher things all the time. So that will naturally produce a huge storehouse of good samskaras. So what happens, as I mentioned, the mind is a bundle. So if you feel a strong conflict, a great stumbling block whenever you try to meditate, then what it means is some of the samskaras, maybe you have a majority of negative samskaras which stand in the way of your trying to do what you want to do. So what you should do, you should go on creating positive samskaras so that they will become the majority. So that consciously we must try to practice. So the yama niyamas are really meant for that. One, this swadhyaya, you know, there's a mention, swadhyaya dvam, I mean, isupanidhana, but two mentioned here as well. Shauja sandosha tapaswadhyaya isupanidhana. So the last two niyamas are very important. Swadhyaya here means repetition of from sacred mantras or feeding the mind with good ideas, good thoughts by reading good books with meaning, and also a kind of resignation which when sincere will force your mind to think always of higher ideas. When you resign to God or some higher idea, then the awareness that you have resigned everything to a higher idea, well, God will help you to connect and link all your actions and thoughts with that idea. That means every action becomes a way, an opportunity to create good samskaras. Good samskaras can be created. We can make consciously do that. So once we succeed in creating a lot of good samskaras, you find our whole personality changes. That's a mystery which I mentioned many times. See, our mind influences our actions. That's natural. Everyone knows. But do actions influence the mind? Suppose you do some good deeds, unselfish deeds, pure words, or what pure thoughts. Do they have an effect on the mental health? They do have. So, good words, pure thoughts, good actions, they also will create good samskaras. And when these good samskaras increase, one important sign is the conflicts come down. Or you feel at home when you are doing good things. You feel don't feel much of many conflicts when you are doing good deeds. After all, that's what happens. So, thank you. Now we will have, please remember, the next session on November 4th. We will have no class on Friday, October the 21st. So the next class will be on Friday, November the 4th. Okay. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om. That's it. Sri Ram Krishna.